Welcome back to Practically Intelligent. As always, I'm your host, Anand Osmer, and with me, as always, is my partner in crime, Akshay. And today, we have an extremely exciting episode for you all. We've been talking a lot about the innovative properties of AI, and as we should, and it's also going to be good for us to take a look at some industry leaders in the space of not just specific verticals of AI, like finance, but also taking a look at some of the regulatory components to the AI ecosystem, how they've evolved and how they are translating and showing lessons learned today. So Akshay, who are we talking to today?
We're chatting with Philip Treleaven, professor at the University College of London. Philip is a pioneer in AI, very well known in the UK artificial intelligence research community. He was famously directing, and it still is, the Financial Computing Center at UCL. And so when algorithmic trading was coming online to create a free and fair market, there's a lot of regulation that needed to be put in place by the UK equivalent of sort of the SEC, et cetera. So Philip has some incredible lessons there. Most importantly, he has spawned off many entrepreneurial ventures, most famously DeepMind came out of University College London. There's been a host of new startups, some TOLA funded as well, that have come out of recently out of UCL. When I spoke with Philip's students, he has had such a profound impact through his push to both regulators and his reframe to students on why shouldn't they be the entrepreneurs starting the company? And so when I asked several of our friends across the pond who I should interview for the podcast and who we should interview Sanan, he was the first name to come up of someone who's had a profound impact on his students. I'm really excited to get his perspective as we enter this new era of AI, where a lot of the public is asking questions around regulation, what is responsible AI? And I'm also, as a VC and Sanan, you're a founder, get excited to talk to someone who's had just founders say so many great things about him.
Well, then let's dive right in.
Awesome. Professor, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation.
I wanted to start during your time working with the Financial Conduct Authority in the UK. You were responsible for shaping both innovation and regulation just as algorithmic trading was coming on as a technology. And I thought that was an interesting corollary. We talk a lot about AI in and future projections, but you were working with a very similar technology as it reshaped a specific market. So I'd love for you to talk a little bit about the history and the work you did with the Financial Conduct Authority, just to set the groundwork for our listeners.
Sure. For context, it be nice to talk about the journey of how we got there. We're one of the top computer science departments in Europe, and probably the top department for AI and blockchain. And we're also in central London. So organizations come to us with unsolvable problems, and we just get the students to work on them, and we don't charge them because it makes great projects for the students. Now, probably about 30 years ago, the London Stock Exchange came along and said, we've got this terrible problem with insider dealing, huge reputational damage, and no one's got a clue how to solve it. And then we do what we normally do, is just ask the students, anybody want to work on this? And four of my PhD students built the first insider dealing detection system for the London Stock Exchange. And sometimes we don't grasp the significance of what we're doing. You know, you might say we're a bit naive. And one day the Financial Times published a front page, half the front page, UCL builds pioneering insider dealing detection system. Five people detected and were are being prosecuted, you see. So unknown to us, they'd actually put the damn thing into, into execution. Now, and on the back of that, we developed a lot of the early financial fraud detection systems about 25 years ago with the banks and spun out a very successful company. But this led to us being approached by the Financial Conduct Authority, the SEC equivalent in the UK, and they were interested in the impact of technology, and at that stage they were just sort of handing out contracts to big tech companies just to build things for them. And I said, well, the big tech companies really don't know what they're doing. You'll be spend all the time educating them. And what I did was I persuaded them to just get in, sort of $20,000 data science software and let the staff play around with it. And on the back of that, we then developed various things as they got more and more expertise and automated regulation. And we started these things called tech sprints, which was their name for hackathons, when we tackled different areas. We set up a sandbox, which is very important to allow people to experiment and not, to be in some ways over-regulated, in that the regulators, kept a very tight rein on them. And we also built built the students to build a lot of experimental software for the Financial Conduct Authority. And the great thing now is they're really good at AI and blockchain, automated regulation, and they're a nice exemplar both for other regulators, particularly in finance around the world, but also for other public sector organizations that really need to raise the game in regulation.
So the concepts, hackathons, sprints, sandboxes, these concepts are still very much around. These are still things that people talk about, and maybe in a limited capacity, in the sense that it's less computer science students who are experiencing that kind of ecosystem, but more startups and entrepreneurs who are experiencing that level of work. At the same time, insider trading is still very much around. What other through lines do you see from your work, working with the London Stock Exchange all the way through today, and potentially going even forward with large language models and general generative AI? What other kinds of lessons learned do you think that we should be extracting?
What we don't talk about is that the internet's been driven by adult entertainment. It's the online payments, streaming, blah blah blah. At the moment, we're just about to experience a tsunami of cybercrime. Just crypto currency mm-hmm. crime is in 2021. I think it was $4 billion. In 2022, it was $7 billion, mm-hmm. and in 2023, it was $27 billion. And when you go into cybercrime in general, rather than just crypto crime, you're talking about trillions. Now, the regulatory model is to collect data speculatively, and then retrospectively analyze a bit of it. The problem is that doesn't work when you're getting a tsunami of cybercrime. You need to do real-time compliance and regulation so that you can stop it. So the problem is that I think for the next 3 or 4 years, until it's closed, until it's sort of constrained, cybercrime is going to drive financial regulation and compliance. If you think about money laundering and KYC and things like this, these really are minor league compared to what people are doing in stealing billions. And the regulators really need to go to a decentralized form of regulation and not just retrospectively gather data, because, you know, it's like the police stopping a mugger on the street. You know, it's very visible, but somebody is making off with a few billion. It puts the mugger in, you know, Philly minor league things. So we've been arguing that the regulators need to use the same technologies that everybody's using, like decentralized finance, federated machine learning, distributed data sets, you know, blockchain technology for privacy. And they need to do sort of real-time compliance reporting rather than, you know, just doing it historically. Obviously, they're not happy with the suggestion. You know, it's a root and branch thing. But at some stage, and you could argue that it's already happened, that cybercrime is going to become an epidemic. And already you're seeing criminals, you know, using things like generative AI, large language models to generate, you know, deep fakes,
voicemails from Biden.
Yeah, all of these sorts of things, you know, you can guess. You know, people are hacking blockchain infrastructures. You know, and this is something that even blockchain experts probably will have difficulty understanding what they're doing, but the rewards are so enormous that this is the sort of, you could say, happy time for criminals and innovation. Yep. When a new innovation like deep fakes emerges, there's a time before the criminals get in there and harvest it until the society actually is aware of what's going on. And starts to address it. And
yeah, so first adult entertainment comes in, then the criminals, and then governments will take action. So honestly, that's a pretty tried and true methodology. Philip, that's interesting, because what advice then, what should the government officials actually be doing? Is it as simple as get them up to date on this technology, get people in there who are actually knowledgeable? Like, what solid advice do they need?
Awareness. And the police, the judicial system, the regulators. You know, we do a lot of horizon scanning with the regulators, but there's a lot of difference in, you know, looking at, you know, what emerging problems, to the fact that, you know, some bank may have lost billions, you know, money just disappears. And we're right at the center of the, you might call it the revolution. And I, for example, a couple of years ago, I said, oh, in the next 2 years, we're going to see avatars behaving badly and making rude suggestions to people, and things like this. And the next day I opened the newspapers and some company had been banned, I think, by one country, because, you know, and there was I saying 2 years. What I should have been saying is 2 hours. You know, it's already happened. You're going to get criminal algorithms. You're going to get super intelligent algorithms created, or super intelligent algorithms that just evolve to become criminal without realizing they're criminal. And, you know, this is the brave new world. And even if you spend all your life, you know, in generative AI and blockchain tokenization, you probably don't appreciate what's going on. And 98% of, you know, the public and regulators, and it's like, you know, with deep fakes, if you record 3 seconds, just 3 seconds of a conversation with somebody, you can completely replicate their voice and have them say anything. So both my wife and I have PhDs in computer science. You pick the phone up and you say yes, you know, sort of paranoia. But my guess is the regulators just, you know, are ill-prepared in terms of, you know, understanding what's happening.
One thing that you said, Philip, that was surprising was you were, those sprints, those hackathons, those were in collaboration with the London Stock Exchange and regulators. So something we don't frequently hear is regulators using innovation to assist them with controlling and assisting the development of a new technology like AI. Could you actually, how did you get the London Stock Exchange to work in that sort of format? What was that conversation?
It wasn't the London Stock Exchange. It was really the Financial Conduct Authority, or SEC, that got into it. And we're lucky that we're in the centre of London, surrounded by all these world-class, you know, investment banks and retailers and law firms and that. And they use this as an innovation resource. So I've got 1,400, you know, students in the department. And they like to do projects with outside organizations. We don't charge for them. Excuse me. And it's a great knowledge transfer mechanism. So companies come to us with really interesting and problems. It was like we built the first algorithmic trading platform with Deutsche Bank, and it was sort of a rerun. This is about 20 years ago now, the first in Europe, sorry. And Deutsche Bank came along and said, you know, there's a lot of discussion about automating trading. We thought we might build a fixed income system. Do you want to get involved? And again, you know, we got some students, you know, involved in it. We work with them. And then just like the stock exchange, you know, unknown to us, they put the damn thing into operation. It was making a ton of money for them, you know, and a few days later, every bank in London, you know, was calling saying, you know, can you get some students to help us build, you know, an algorithmic trading or a systematic trading platform. And, it's great experience. It's exciting for all of us, including the students, to see our work, mm-hmm. you know, put into place. I'll give you an example in the regulatory area. So I was advising the Financial Conduct Authority, and two of my master's students wanted to build a chatbot. And I said, what are you going to do? And they said, oh, we thought we might do something in HR. I said, I thought it would sound a bit dull. And I knew all the sort of problems that the Financial Conduct Authority had, one of them being their call center. They were getting sort of 400 calls a year, you know, from people saying, do I need to be, you know, do I need to register, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And it was sort of overwhelming them. So I said, well, why don't you do something for the regulators, like trying to automate their call center, build a POC? And they said, sounds great. And I said, you know, you can, we've got all the Alexa technology, you know, because we collaborate with everybody, just use Alexa and try and build something. And the Financial Conduct Authority got hugely excited. The students were hugely excited. I thought it was going to go pear-shaped. So I was saying, you know, well, just hold on, it probably won't work. And when the students built a POC, and when we went to demonstrate it to the Financial Conduct Authority, the guy in charge of the call center said it actually did a better job than his staff in answering the questions. But the nice thing about that is the Financial Conduct Authority then had a POC that they were able to go out and, you know, get industrially built. Mm-hmm. Do it. So, and the students were, you know, pretty pleased that, you know, that they'd done this. So everybody was, you know, it was nice for everybody. And then that got the, you know, every success like that led to the, you know, the regulators trying something, you know, even more interesting.
So on that note, so this, you've brought this up a few times now, which is for me as a teacher and former lecturer, getting students involved can be transformative all around. Yeah. But twice now, two of your stories have ended with work being done that was put into, you know, production or actually used, seemingly without limited knowledge from your side, which turns out looks like it all turned out great. But, you know, I see a world where the headlines could have just as easily been students make algorithm that absolutely flops. And frankly, it wouldn't really be the students' fault at all. They had no idea this was going to be actually stress tested. So
yeah.
my question then is, what is the ideal pipeline of innovation? Is it from workers, students, professors, academics, directly to corporations and government organizations, or should there be something in the middle to kind of mediate that process and defining goals? And what do you see as that ideal pipeline?
So we've got this almost unorganized, I think it's laissez-faire way. Somebody turns up with a project, you see if anybody wants to do it. So there are three ways you can do innovation, and I've done advisory work on these big government programs, all over the world. But firstly, you can write academic papers, these peer-reviewed papers. I have to say, it gets you promoted, but, they don't have much impact. Secondly, there were in the 80s and 90s, there were these big government programs that, academics were working with big companies. But the big companies can be notoriously slow. And the final thing is that you can do a startup, or, you can do a sort of entrepreneurship thing with a company. And these work very well because everybody's focused on doing something that's going to have commercial impact. So the first thing we do is probably about 70% of our students do their projects with outside organizations and, big investment banks, big law firms, and startups, big retailers, advertisers, etc. But increasingly, startups will use the students as an innovation resource because they can build anything. And interestingly, the students are getting better, which many people can say. And we're also getting a number of people that have worked for 10 years who will come back to do machine learning or blockchain. That works very well. And 20 to 25% of the students now will do a research project that might become a startup. And this works very well. We've had a lot of success. My research group's probably spun out 50, 60 startups that have been sold for small amounts of money, like $10 million or something. But, for one student, it's not a bad payday. But we've also had things that that ex-students have sold for, $1.5 billion, is dollars. And, they find it exciting, and they'll do a project not to make the money, but because they find the technology and impact exciting. So what we tend to do is almost act like a dating agency, and get the students to work with a company, or we'll help them shape a startup idea that's got legs, and that will inspire them. And we've also got a number of professionals will come to us and say, whether they're in a company or whether they're doing it on their own, I've got an idea. Can you find me some resource to help me realize it? And the thing that we're interested in now is to try and automate this because it's starting to get a bit overwhelming. But it sort of works. People are inspired. You're enabling the students to do something they find super interesting, and everybody gets something out of it. And we, the companies tell us some really fantastic ideas. They pay for everything, so you don't need to go through the normal government bureaucracy, which is a nightmare. And the banks used to give me cash to test their systems. This was the sort of ultimate. And I said to one head of trading, I said, I think I'm more worried about losing your money than you are, you see. He said, $100,000. This is, they're sort of cursing me. Just get on with it. If you need more money, call me. It's exciting, but not particularly well organized, I think is the best way to describe it.
It's pretty interesting, Philip, because a lot of what you're talking about, you're using a lot of commercial terms in an academic context, which Sanan's a former YC founder, a lot of what you're saying of finding a POC, listening to a customer, like solving a use case, and then seeing whether they're paid for it. It actually, Sanan, it reminds me a lot of sort of YC's early advice. That's pretty surprising. You know, we hear about it now in sort of these innovation garages across universities, but it's super interesting that, you know, you all have been doing that in the 80s, 90s, and so on. And it's probably explains a lot of UCL's outsized impact in AI. So that's actually really interesting that
people just
POC terminology to describe their PhD students' work. That's
pretty interesting. The students understand it. They find it exciting. Companies like it. You know, somebody, one of the big banks, said to me, the great thing about this is we give them a project. If it fails, no one's going to get fired. So they give them the hairy projects that to do, and the students often, you know, succeed, you know, they're just driven by it. And you know, what we're trying to do is always raise everybody's game and aspiration. And the other thing we're trying to do, because of the sort of AI education revolution, is see how we can actually do the same sort of thing with high school students. Or, you know, can you teach 10-year-olds, you know, using Scratch Junior to program or something like this? So we're always trying to drive the same sort of ecosystem down into schools now, and that. And it's all about enabling the students. So, you know, it's their project, it's not my project, and all we do is really mentor them, and we're looking for, you know, better ways to help them, I guess, is the best thing.
But one thing that's a lot of universities now at innovation programs, you have a very distinct sort of matchmaking service that seems to repeatably work, right? So I'd love to talk about, when you talk about the support you provide students or the way you interact with enterprises, do you think there's anything special about the way you and what you've enabled UCL to do that's distinct? You talked a little bit about factors outside of your control, like the fact that you're in the center of London, but that it clearly just isn't the only factor, right? It isn't free labor and smart kids. You've enabled some things repeatedly.
We're probably just replicating things that Stanford have been and the others have been doing for years. You know, and you just the good thing is we've got a tremendous resource, which is the students. And the students find, you know, building projects with outside organizations really inspirational. And there's a very sort of gentle way for doing a research project with some organizations that, you know, it's just a research project, you know, et cetera. And then there's a sort of segue into commercializing it. And you've already got some what look like clients. I think the great thing is we've got a great network, and the students are increasingly skillful, so it's like a big incubator from that point of view. So, you know, it's like that's really all it is. So I don't want to overclaim for it, but just encouraging the students to work with outside organizations and do their own thing is all we do. Really,
it's hard. It's a harder thing for a lot of institutions in the United States for whatever reason. I am on record having left Hopkins after getting my master's because, very specifically, I fell in love with startups. I did a startup with my fraternity brothers. I loved it so much. I decided I did not want my PhD anymore. I wanted to go work in companies. It never occurred to me that those two things could be related because it was always billed to me as, you're either an academic or you are a startup founder. And I chose startup founder. In my ideal world, I am both. I am both an academic and an entrepreneur, which is happening more and more today in the States, but it seems like it's just not quite where everyone else is. And I think that's where a lot of people are going to be fascinated.
The problem is that academics are promoted by writing peer-reviewed
Publishing peer-reviewed papers, exactly.
Yeah. Whereas the students, I asked one of my PhD students that I was not one I was supervising, one I was funding. I said, "How did his supervisor feel about him working with this company?" And he said, "Oh, I want you back at the university writing papers for me." I said, "What did you say?" He said, "I suggested he employ somebody." You've got a lot of ballsy students, you see, who see other people, you know, doing interesting things. So the culture rises, and that's all it is. And we introduce the student. We've got a fantastic set of mentors. You know, they people are really generous with their time with the students. So the students are meeting, you know, really senior people, and you know, it just raises the game. And that what are we poor at? Part of the education system, the students can build anything. They're world class. They're hopeless, or not hopeless, that's probably a bit overstated, but they're not very good at business development. You know, their comfort zone is building things, not picking up the phone and trying to, you know, find out what people want to buy or want to engage with. But then doing it as a research project sort of gets some, you know, some of them get it. Some of them might have real problems with stop building, get on the phone, talk to people about what they want. You know, so there's still things work in progress, as it were, but it's just the thing that probably inspires the students most is to see their colleagues actually doing exciting things with, you know, big name institutions or exciting startups.
I think one thing that's particularly interesting, it's so easy when people, they're talking about an end state, right, that was achieved at UCL that sort of mimics Stanford's National Geographic and historical advantages in the Valley. When I kept asking students who knew you, Philip, the two words I repeatedly kept hearing were encouragement and culture, a lot of which you fostered. So I know we're talking about the programs currently in place of, you know, connecting students to enterprises, helping their work and research be less about necessarily peer review, but actually solving a customer problem. But you had a profound impact where you were a professor of entrepreneurship. You started a lot of this cultural change. So I'd love to understand how you...
I'm professor of computer science. I'm not professor of entrepreneurship.
You taught an entrepreneurial course, though, I believe, students. I'd love to talk through... This didn't exist, right? Throughout UCL's history, you fostered a lot of it. So can you talk to me a little bit about, when you say encourage students, what were specific conversations and key inflection points in their path as a student that you think your advice had an impact? And what did you say to them that encouraged them to start a company?
Have you thought of commercializing it? That's all you say. And they know that the others have done very well. I've got students come to me with interesting startup ideas. I have a list of things. So, you know, we're very good at AI, and the obvious, we're very good at finance, you know, know all the people in London. I was wanting to do something in, you know, generative AI for fund management, you know, to not to do fund management, but actually generate personal portfolios, you know, for the fund managers then to review. Okay, it's a pretty obvious project, you know, just following what's happened in the legal services area, you know, with these things like Harvey AI. Serendipity, one of the female MS master students said to me, you know, I've been an investment manager for 10 years. I want to do something with generative AI. I said, you know, me too. And then we rounded up a number of undergraduates, and they are just obsessed with, you know, generative AI, and they've read every paper and, you know, not something I say in the department. They probably know more about generative AI than the staff, which probably would get them killed. But now they built quite an, you know, technically interesting system. We've got some stellar advisors, you know, like the CEO of one of the largest trading platforms in the world is, you know, mentoring them. So, you know, And we're now discussing, you know, what to do to, you know, take it commercial. You know, in terms of, you know, do we target fund managers or family offices, high net worth individuals, wealth management in large firms? You know, which geographical region do we work in? But, where the UK is actually quite useful because it's got, you know, links to the Middle East, you know, Latin America, etc.
Yeah,
but it really is unorganized. It's just a case of suggesting, you know, are you interested in actually trying to commercialize it, and what do you want to do?
So you've mentioned a few people in passing already, but I'm curious: are there any other stories of students whose entrepreneurial journeys kind of stick out with you, have stuck with you for a while?
Oh, you talk about stuck. I used to joke: we give them a degree and never see them again, and now you can't get rid of them. Sometimes we take them on as research assistants, meaning that I pay them and they do what they like, which the government sort of, you know, moderately happy with. And that works quite well, but, you know, it'd be nice to institutionalize it, but, you know, and that. But, I'll give you an example. I've got a student from Nigeria who did a master's with me last year. I was his project supervisor. And he did something in sort of ethical AI or something, and he's now gone back to Lagos and set up an AI company. And I chat with him once a week, and he's built some software. It's got some clients, and you get the impression that he knows what he's doing. And you know, you ask him for a pitch deck, it looks pretty reasonable. You know, I give him some feedback, and but I haven't really, apart from giving him some mentoring, I think he'll do very well. You know, Africa's a nice sort of greenfield site, and that. But that's the example of he wanted to do it. I give him some bit of mentoring, and off he goes. We've had, you know, two of the students sold a company to a big unnamed American company for $26 million. That was very helpful because that was a bit close to home for the other students. So it shook them up a bit and, got more of them going. But, you know, the ecosystem grows. So we expect that, you know, startups help each other. And, you know, we don't have UCL is an incubator, but none of our students, none of my students, go into it. They just go and camp with a startup for free. So we expect them to help each other, and they do. So, you know, good news, as I say. The other thing that's relevant to you is that America is seen as the target market for all of our startups. The American tech VCs are staffed with successful tech entrepreneurs and engineers. The UK ones tend to be staffed with ex-financial people who don't really understand the technology. So our startups end up doing, you know, taking VC money from the US, typically, or high net worth individual, you know, tech individuals, and doing the Delaware flip, I think you call it, you know, which is, they go from, you know, the UK, and all of them, and Emory is a good example to say, you know, you can't believe how much easier it is to do business, you know, and get things going in the US than it is in Europe. So it's an interesting thing, but not much point in telling the government, but that, you know, this is the sort of standard pathway for our startups.
Well, hopefully Rishi and the rest of the UK government can have as profound of an impact on entrepreneurship as you've had on your students. Professor, thanks so much for taking the time with us. This was a fascinating walkthrough from RegTech to innovation to the impact on your students. Thanks so much for joining us.
No, thank you for the invitation. Okay.